Texas Fish and Game Magazine, July-August 2025 issue, audio edition. In this issue, the basics of night fishing, tips from the Fish and Game Saltwater Playbook, compiled by Texas Fish and Game staff, stocking up, wins and losses in Texas wildlife stocking efforts, feature story by Chester Moore, fishing tech, a look at the smart gadgets available for anglers, feature story by Matt Williams. So, you've lost your lease. Hunting leases are getting more expensive and harder to find. Why? And are there alternatives? Feature story by Chester Moore. Charmed by Snakes Part 2. Doggett's Texas Snake Adventures Continue. Feature article by Joe Doggett. Gone Coastal. Fishing is serious fun for Fish and Game saltwater columnist Kelly Gross. The Fish and Game Profile Series. Get ready for the fall. An autumn checklist for hunters and anglers. Fish and Game Special Section. Plus columns, outdoor news in the Fish and Game Report, coastal focus reports by professional saltwater guides, and more. So listen, learn, and enjoy. Speaking up in defense of recreational fishing. Inside Fish and Game by Roy and Ardia Neves. American Sport Fishing Association, ASA, is the national organization that guards the well-being of the fishing industry. While groups like Coastal Conservation Association, CCA, promote the interests of anglers, ASA is a trade association that represents the interests of the recreational fishing industry. They put on the annual ICAST show, which is the largest convention of fishing industry players in the world, and the showcase each year of the latest fishing gear and innovations. We've attended and reported from ICAST for over 30 years. More importantly, ASA represents its fishing industry members before the lawmakers and regulatory agencies at state and federal levels. This is important to the angling public because the organization understands that, without them, anglers, there would be no fishing industry. So advocating for the rights and protections of sport fishing, nationwide, is as critical to their mission as looking out for the business interests of their members. To that end, ASA has taken a leadership role in addressing the threats posed by the chaos and uncertainty of the on-then-off-then-on-again tariffs initiated by the current federal executive branch. It is also speaking up in defense of sport fishing as commercial fishing interests lobby for greater control of America's limited fishing resources. On June 4th, Martha Gaez, ASA's Southeast Fisheries Policy Director, appeared before Congress at an oversight hearing, Restoring American Seafood Competitiveness. This hearing aimed to clear the way for the administration's push to open federally protected waters to more commercial fishing. As a representative of the recreation fishing industry, Ms. Gaez was there to present testimony to ensure any actions by Congress and then by the administration would not be at the expense of recreational anglers and businesses, especially in the face of mounting economic uncertainty fueled by tariff chaos. The pre-hearing document presented a compelling case that recreational fishing is far more important to the U.S. economy than commercial fishing. According to the document, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, for example, found that outdoor recreation activities, including fishing, accounted for 2.3% of overall gross domestic product in 2023, or nearly $640 billion. Meanwhile, it stated that commercial fishing and seafood industry generated more than $183 billion in economic value in sales and supported 1.6 million jobs in 2022. While those commercial numbers aren't insignificant, the contrast is striking. Outdoor recreation, and specifically sport fishing, generates more than three times the economic value. And yet, when federal policymakers talk about fisheries and American seafood competitiveness, the needs of recreational anglers can be omitted from the conversation. That's why ASA's involvement is so critical. The organization isn't just pushing back against lopsided resource management. It's reminding lawmakers that this isn't a niche hobby or a sideline sport. Recreational fishing is a cultural and economic pillar that supports real jobs in real towns across the country, especially in coastal and rural areas where few industries offer the same reach. From mom-and-pop tackle shops and charter captains to boat manufacturers and gear suppliers, Thousands of small businesses depend on healthy, accessible fisheries. And anglers, by and large, are good stewards of those resources. When managed fairly, the recreational sector contributes to conservation through license sales, excise taxes, and ongoing habitat advocacy. That contribution needs to be respected in the same breath as domestic seafood production. Complicating matters is the continued ripple effect of erratic trade policy. Tariffs on fishing tackle, boat parts, and marine electronics don't just inconvenience big brands, they crush small manufacturers and increase costs for consumers. ASA has consistently warned that poorly considered tariffs hurt American anglers and the businesses that support them. The result? Fewer options, higher prices, and more economic stress on an industry already battling supply chain issues and uncertain regulations. Trade policy is complicated, but the outcome is simple. Anglers pay more, businesses struggle, and innovation stalls. ASA has consistently pushed back against short-sighted tariff schemes that don't account for how tightly integrated the global recreational fishing supply chain really is. Broad and randomly applied tariffs create a hardship that many otherwise innovative producers simply cannot overcome. So where does this all lead? Ideally, to a point where policymakers understand that recreational fishing isn't a footnote in the seafood conversation. It's a cornerstone of the American outdoor economy. Recreational fishing doesn't need special treatment, but it does deserve fair treatment. Groups like ASA and CCA are out there pushing that message, but it's up to all of us to keep that message echoing loud and clear. Email Ardia at aneves@fishgame.com. Email Roy at rneves@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. The Girl, The Mountain Goat, and The Promise. Editor's Notes. By Chester Moore, Texas Fish and Game Editor-in-Chief. He makes my feet like those of a deer and enables me to climb on mountain heights. Those words echoed through my head as I watched my daughter Faith take photos of a beautiful Rocky Mountain goat at 14,000 feet in Colorado. We live at 14 feet elevation on the Texas coast, so being 1,000 times higher is like stepping into another world, a place of stunning beauty and unlimited possibility. 17 years ago, we got word about an opportunity to adopt a little girl who at age 2 couldn't walk or talk and was diagnosed with cerebral palsy. I felt this was the child we had prayed for, but I needed confirmation. So, I did what all great spiritual people do, I played Bible roulette. I walked over to my Bible and picked it up. Lord, you know me. I am hard-headed and sometimes cannot see things the way you want me to see them. I am on faith going to open up this Bible and believe the page I land on is the place that will give me confirmation this is our girl or is not. I do not need a cryptic answer, but a direct one, Lord. With some apprehension, I sort of flipped the Bible open and flung it down on my table. At first, I thought it landed on a blank page, but I quickly realized it was on a page with only one verse, and it was the very end of the book. Yahweh, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like those of a deer and enables me to climb mountain heights. I was stunned. I read those words over and over as tears rolled down my face, and I felt the presence of the Lord in an incredibly profound, powerful way. I knew she would walk. I knew she would talk. And I know God had special things to be done through her. Over the years, we have faced many challenges, especially emotional ones. There were times it looked like the full promise of mountain heights might not happen. There were times I cried myself to sleep, seeing the challenges she was going through at a young age. There were times my wife Lisa and I were frustrated and exhausted, but we had a promise, and we stood on it. We prayed that promise through and stood on God's word that this precious child would climb on mountain heights physically, mentally, and spiritually. As she turned back to me on Mount Blue Sky, I snapped back into the present and could see her beaming with pride. Dad, I got a really good picture. Look. This was in the cell phone photography category, and thankfully this one mountain goat was in a perfect position, in good light, and Faith has a great eye for composition and capturing little moments. Look at this one. It looks like he's talking to me. That photo was entered into a national fine arts competition for Assemblies of God churches around the nation. Both her cell and digital photo of an elk earned her an invite to national competition in Columbus, Ohio. In front of 15,000 people at Nationwide Arena, Faith learned that her mountain goat photo not only received a superior rating, but earned her the top photo and the prestigious Award of Merit and a scholarship. Out of a possible three-judge rating of 120, she earned 119 points, which is super rare in these competitions. Faith is not the most emotional young lady, but she broke down and cried when she heard the announcement and received the support of her fellow community church youth group members. It was a huge moment for her and for our family. A child that wasn't supposed to walk or talk was in front of thousands of people taking home a serious award for a photo she took at 14,000 feet in Colorado. That certainly qualifies as mountain heights to the literal zenith of its meaning. And it was an important moment for us as a family for another reason. She won for wildlife photography. And as a family of dedicated wildlife conservationists, this was special. We love mountain goats and are members of the Rocky Mountain Goat Alliance, a group dedicated to their conservation. And we are members of the Wild Sheep Foundation and Texas Bighorn Society, groups dedicated to wild sheep, which we also photographed on that same mountain on that trip. Faith Moore made me very proud with her awesome photo and winning at such a high level. But more importantly, she's made me proud because of who she is and doing her part to work hard and contribute to conservation. At the time of this writing, we got word she qualified for nationals again, and for a photo of a Rocky Mountain bighorn she photographed near our beloved Estes Park, Colorado. We look forward to seeing what great things come through her in the future, and remain in awe of seeing the promise over her fulfilled. No matter the odds against a kid in your life, never give up on them. Never. Great things can happen for them and through them. And the great outdoors is a wonderful place to create mentoring relationships that can help make their dreams a reality. Email Chester Moore at cmoore@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. The Need for Speed? Pike on the Edge by Doug Pike, Texas Fish and Game Senior Contributing Editor. Registered boats are required to carry specific safety gear that's designed to save lives, but none of that gear matters if the boat's going so fast that everyone in it is ejected in a collision. In a two-week span earlier this year, across several states, multiple people lost their lives in boating accidents, and in each of those instances, at least one of the boats involved was traveling at a high rate of speed. Same as in auto racing, boats get faster every year. In early May, a race boat on Lake Havasu went airborne at what several sources estimated was around 200 miles per hour. Dramatic video is out there. Take a look. It's testament to the safety features in those boats, and by nothing short of a miracle, that neither man on that boat was killed. Fishing boats don't go that fast yet, but the fastest hauls out there now tickle the 100 miles per hour mark, and that may be a line the industry doesn't need to cross. At least not yet. I'm not opposed to fast boats. My grandfather built racing hydroplanes and their engines. Their speed fascinated me. I even got to run one, once, briefly, because the acceleration spooked me a little. Never knelt in that little boat again. Today, the faster you get where you're going, the more time you have to fish, right? And fishing is why most of us want to go faster. The trouble, though, is that to drive a boat safely at 80, 90, or 100 plus miles per hour requires special skills that most boat operators don't have. For perspective, at 100 miles per hour, you're covering almost 50 yards per second. So even if you do see a half-submerged log, half a football field ahead, you have less than a second to decide whether to zig left or zag right, and only one shot at getting it right. Too often this past spring, high-speed boat drivers are getting it wrong. In many states, the only requirements for running at triple-digit speed across a lake or bay are being seated at the wheel of that boat and knowing how to start it. You don't have to own it, and you don't have to understand how it handles. No experience required. For accidents during that dreadful 2 weeks or so earlier this year, aside from operator inattention, the common thread in all those fatal accidents was that the drivers of one or both boats had no professional instruction in handling boats at any speed. Zero. Driving fast in a straight line over unoccupied, slightly rippled water isn't especially challenging, except for the underwater obstacle factor. Add any twists, chop, teenagers on personal watercraft, blinding glare off the surface, alcohol, and the risk factor skyrockets. Worth noting, on a positive note, I don't recall alcohol being a factor in any of those spring crashes. That's good, but it also emphasizes how dangerous speed on the water can be, even for sober operators. Preaching to the choir is something I seldom do, but now seems an opportune time to share again that lakes and bays are entirely unlike streets and highways. Open lakes and bays have no traffic lanes, no red lights or stop signs or designated merging lanes. There actually are rules that tell licensed captains how to approach and pass other vessels safely, but recreational boaters aren't required to learn any of that. The only logical conclusion to be drawn from what's happened thus far with rocket-fast boats is this: not enough lives have been lost yet to draw attention. We haven't had to attend enough unnecessary funerals for boater education to become mandatory prior to the operation of any boat, even kayaks, because kayakers must be prepared in an instant to deal with the people in high-powered boats who might be distracted. I discussed boater education on the radio at length for several weeks around the times of those fatal crashes, and several interesting ideas came up. Seat belts and airbags, flashing lights, law enforcement with radar like what's used on highways. All interesting conceptually, but none remotely functional. Most of those remedies would only come into play after someone already was operating a boat unsafely. You don't get a speeding ticket until you're speeding. Airbags don't deploy unless you hit something really hard. And more lights on boats likely would cause more distraction, same as those dreadful flashing lights on the backs of commercial vehicles, as if we wouldn't see them. Lighting boats like fire trucks would only create further distraction from what's off the bow, which is the only place where things on or in the water really matter. The way to reduce horrific boating accidents is through instruction long before they happen, even before the boat comes off the trailer and slides into the water. Boat owners need to know how boats operate, how they accelerate, how they turn, how they stop, how they maneuver at speed. I'm not saying we need PhD-level training to take the kids out on the pontoon boat, but I would feel more comfortable knowing that the guy behind the console of the boat coming my way at 20 miles per hour or 90 miles per hour had completed at the very least an online course in how not to slam into other boats. Email Doug Pike at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. The basics of night fishing. From the Fish and Game Saltwater Playbook, feature article by Texas Fish and Game staff. There's something about the Texas coast after dark that feels like a different world. But for seasoned anglers, nightfall doesn't signal the end of a fishing trip, but the beginning. Night fishing on the Texas coast can be as productive as it is peaceful, and in many cases, even more rewarding than fishing in the heat and hustle of daylight hours. It can be incredibly effective, said Texas Fish and Game boating editor Lenny Rudow in his guide to night fishing. In fact, at many times of the year, the night bite can be better than the action during daylight, if, that is, you know how to fish in the darkness. Why fish after nightfall? From the Port Aransas jetties to the piers of Galveston, anglers have long known that some species feed more aggressively in low light. Predators like speckled trout, redfish, and black drum are particularly active during these cooler, quieter hours. The water's surface calms, boat traffic dies down, bait fish venture out from cover, and larger game fish come in closer to shore under the cover of night. One of the biggest reasons night fishing shines along the coast is simple: lower temperatures. Especially in the warmer months, the water cools slightly at night, creating a more comfortable and oxygen-rich environment for fish as well. That means more movement, more feeding, and more chances to hook into something memorable. The magic of lights. If you're going to fish at night, choose an area with artificial lighting, Rudow said. He's right, and this is perhaps the most important tip for inshore night fishing in Texas. Whether you're on a dock, pier, or bridge, areas with strong overhead or submerged lights are magnets for bait fish. Shrimp, Glass minnows and finger mullet are drawn into the glow, and like clockwork, the predators follow. Watch carefully around dock lights, and you'll often see a feeding rhythm emerge. A swirl here, a flash of silver there. Trout use the contrast between light and dark to ambush their prey. Position your bait or lure on the edge of the light pool where fish are actively hunting. Right bait for the dark. When it comes to bait, live or fresh-cut dead bait is the best. This is especially true along the murky, current-driven channels of the Texas coast. Live shrimp under a popping cork or finger mullet on a Carolina rig can be deadly. The movement and smell of natural bait travel through the water more effectively than artificial lures at night, attracting strikes even when visibility is limited. That said, artificial lures still have their place. Soft plastics in darker colors like black, purple, and brown actually create a more defined silhouette against the night sky when viewed from below. This might seem counterintuitive, but darker lures stand out better in the limited ambient light, mimicking the outline of prey more effectively than bright or translucent colors. However, when fishing directly under lights, some anglers prefer using luminescent colored lures, especially when trout are feeding near the surface. Topwater lures can also be surprisingly effective in calm nighttime waters. A slow, steady retrieve across the surface can produce explosive strikes from hungry trout or redfish drawn to the subtle commotion. Be stealthy and stay aware. Keep in mind, you need to be extra quiet at night. This is especially true when fishing from piers or bulkheads. Heavy footsteps drop tackle boxes, or loud conversations can send wary fish scattering. Try to move with purpose and keep your noise to a minimum. And if you're wading or kayaking, approach likely spots slowly and carefully, especially in the shallows. You'll also want to bring the right gear to help you manage in low light. Ditch the handheld flashlight and opt for a high-quality headlamp. Modern models with red or green lenses are ideal as they provide just enough illumination for tying knots or baiting hooks without spooking fish or ruining your night vision. Popular night fishing spots: Galveston, Seawall, and Piers. With well-lit piers and easy access to both surf and bay fishing, this area is a favorite for night anglers. Trout and reds are common, especially during tide swings. Port Aransas, Horace Caldwell Pier. This long pier extends deep into the Gulf and features lights along the full length. Summer nights can be especially productive for specks and even flounder near the base. Port Isabel Jetties. These rock jetties provide ideal ambush structure for a variety of game fish. Use caution navigating the rocks at night, but the action can be fast and furious. San Luis Pass. Known for strong currents and monster fish, this is a spot that requires experience and respect, but it can produce trophy-sized reds and big black drum after dark. Stay safe. While night fishing is rewarding, it also requires an extra layer of caution. Visibility is limited, and hazards both natural and man-made can become more dangerous after dark. Here are a few essential safety tips to keep in mind. Always fish with a buddy when possible. If you're wading or fishing in remote areas, let someone know your exact plans. Wear a life jacket when fishing from a boat or kayak, especially in unfamiliar waters. Be aware of tides and currents. They can change rapidly along the Texas coast and catch even experienced anglers off guard. Carry a waterproof light, backup batteries, and a fully charged phone. It's easy to misplace gear or get disoriented at night. Watch for wildlife. Stingrays, snakes, and even alligators can be active after dark, especially in marshy or back bay areas. With the right gear, a good plan, and a healthy respect for safety, night fishing on the Texas coast can offer some of the most exciting, productive angling of your life. So next time the sun dips below the horizon, don't pack up. It might be the perfect time to hit the water. Thanks for listening. Stocking up. Texas wildlife stocking efforts include everything from peacock bass and turkeys to walleye and rhinos. Feature article by Chester Moore. When it comes to stocking animals, Texas doesn't just think big. It thinks bold, wild, and sometimes just a little bit weird. From restoring eastern wild turkeys in the piney woods to attempting to raise Nile perch in power plant lakes, the Lone Star State has a rich and highly entertaining history of putting critters back on the land and occasionally in the water. Let's start with the winds. In East Texas, for example, eastern turkeys had vanished from much of their historic habitat. Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, TPWD, initially tried pen-raised birds, but those turkeys didn't take to the woods like their wild cousins. The early releases were a bust, as pen-reared birds simply lacked the survival instincts and smarts of their wild brethren. So, the department changed tactics. TPWD started importing eastern wild turkeys from other states, and it has been highly successful, with around 10,000 eastern turkeys in the Piney Woods, and that number is on the rise. But not every stocking story in Texas has been quite so successful, or quite so, shall we say, terrestrial. Enter the fish oddities. Texas hatcheries are a cornerstone of the state's inland fisheries. Thanks to them, anglers reel in monster bass, hefty catfish, and even rainbow trout in places they wouldn't naturally occur. But TPWD's hatchery logs also reveal some fascinating attempts that didn't quite make a splash. Take the peacock bass, for example. A fan favorite in Florida for its stunning colors and aggressive fight, this exotic fish was stocked in various Texas lakes, Bastrop, Alcoa, Coleto Creek, and Trading House, beginning in 1978. Roughly 19,000 were released. But despite their tenacity and widespread distribution in southern Florida, peacock bass didn't establish populations in Texas waters. Then there was the corvina, or more precisely, the orange-mouth corvina. These salt-loving Pacific Coast bruisers were dropped into Brawnig Lake back in the mid-80s, about 750,000 of them. The idea was thrilling, a freshwater fish that fights like a speckled trout on steroids. Unfortunately, TPWD dropped the concept. The Nile perch, one of the largest freshwater fish on Earth, and a heavyweight in the African Great Lakes, also got a shot at Texas waters. Between 1978 and 1984, about 80,000 were stocked in Brawnig and Coleto Creek lakes. Though they have a fearsome reputation in their native range, they never quite took off in Texas. Let's not forget the tiger muskie, a frankenfish hybrid of the northern pike and muskellunge, famed for its ferocity. TPWD stocked them in several lakes in the late 1970s, including Copper Breaks State Park and Lake Nocona. Similarly, pure muskellunge were introduced into Amistad and Inks Lake. Like their hybrid cousins, they didn't stick around long, and yet, through it all, the state kept swinging. Case in point, walleye. These golden-eyed favorites of northern anglers have been stocked heavily in Texas reservoirs, especially up north. In 2016 alone, more than 3.2 million fry were introduced in lakes like Meredith and Wheeler Branch, with another million plus the year before. Oh, and back in the 70s, they were stocked in Sam Rayburn Reservoir, but like the muskie experiment, it didn't work. More than fishtails, Texas has also led the charge in restoring and protecting big game animals, especially on private lands. Through landowner partnerships and innovative conservation models, species once headed for oblivion have made stunning comebacks. Scimitar-horned oryx and addax have found safe havens in Texas, far from their native ranges. This brings us to one of the boldest ideas to come out of Texas conservation circles yet, rhinos. With poaching decimating rhino populations overseas, driven by black market demand for their horn that fetches up to $60,000 a pound, some conservationists have floated the idea of bringing orphaned baby rhinos to Texas. The thinking goes like this. The state's vast, privately owned ranches already serve as sanctuaries for dozens of non-native species. Why not rhinos? The hope is that Texas could serve as a long-term safety net for rhinos, far from poachers and protected by highly managed, secure ranch lands. A handful of landowners and organizations have expressed interest, and the Exotic Wildlife Association has even endorsed the idea. But while the passion is real and some of the pieces are slowly falling into place, nothing is set in stone. Legal hurdles, international regulations, funding challenges, and logistical puzzles remain. The dream of rhinos roaming a piece of the hill country hasn't been realized yet, but the fact that people are even considering it shows just how imaginative Texas conservation can be. Stocking wildlife, whether it's wild turkeys in East Texas or peacock bass, takes guts, patience, and sometimes a willingness to laugh at your own wild ideas. Not everything has worked, but that's the beauty of Texas. It's a place where trying big, bold things isn't just tolerated. It's the way we do things. Because in Texas, we believe in second chances for species, for habitats, and for those who dare to dream big. Whether it's rebuilding a gobbling turkey population, dreaming up a new fishery, or imagining rhinos grazing in the Edwards Plateau, we're not afraid to dream big and act bigger. Here, conservation isn't just about preserving the past, it's about boldly shaping the future. Thanks for listening. Lost your lease? Hunting leases are getting more expensive and harder to find. Why? And are there alternatives? Feature article by Chester Moore. Losing your deer lease can feel like getting gut kicked. For many hunters, that annual lease isn't just access to land, but is a tradition, a refuge, and a connection to friends, family, and nature. But whether it's due to rising lease prices, land changing hands, or personal conflicts between lease members, losing access can happen suddenly. The good news? There are opportunities to bounce back if you're willing to stay flexible and be creative. Why leases disappear? Let's start with the reality. Deer leases aren't as stable as they used to be. Prices continue to rise, often outpacing inflation, as more people want in on the deer hunting lifestyle. A lease that cost $1,000 a few years ago may now run double or triple that. For many, it's simply not affordable anymore. Then there's the land ownership shuffle. A lot of hunting land is family land, and when the older generation passes, the new owners, nieces, nephews, cousins, might not share the same passion. They may decide it's too much hassle, worry about liability, or want to use the land for something else. Finally, there's the issue nobody wants to talk about, but it's real, and that's personality conflicts. Lease groups can break down due to drama, disagreements over game management, money issues, or even petty squabbles. When these tensions rise, someone's often shown the door, or those who hate drama just check out. If you've lost your lease, it's time to strategize. There's a bigger hunting world out there, and with a little effort and creativity, you can land on your feet or even come out better than before. Consider public land. For real. A lot of hunters roll their eyes at the idea of hunting public land, assuming it's overcrowded or underproductive. But that's not always the case. In fact, with some scouting and persistence, public land can yield some truly impressive bucks and some unforgettable hunts. Many states offer low-cost public hunting permits, and the internet has made it easier than ever to research areas, draw tags, and plan your approach. Texas has a fair amount of public land, but not much compared to states like Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah. Look for overlooked wildlife management areas, walk-in access programs, and national forests. You can also use tools like OnX or HuntStand to explore public-private boundaries and access points. Want a challenge? Go DIY and try for a public land mule deer or elk hunt in a western state. It might be more physical and more demanding, but it's also incredibly rewarding, and bagging a big bull is a great way to turn your deer lease loss into a positive. Barter, trade, or work your way in. We're entering a new age of hunting economy, and that includes trades and barters. Maybe you've got a brush clearing business, or you're handy with tools. Social media is full of stories of folks who got hunting access by offering services from fence building to interior remodeling. Post in regional hunting groups on Facebook or other platforms, offering your services in exchange for hunting access. You'd be surprised how many landowners would love help but don't want the cash commitment of a full lease arrangement. Maybe you've got a unique offering, a private fishing pond, access to good duck or turkey land. Trade days can go both ways. Someone might swap you a deer hunt for access to your crappy honey hole. Explore discount hunts and social media sales. If you haven't joined hunting groups on social media yet, now's the time. Many outfitters post last-minute discounts when someone cancels. One Texas hunter snagged a $500 deer hunt on a quality because the rancher needed to get rid of the animals quickly. That's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity these days at a budget price. In fact, some of the best values out there are in the exotic hunting world. Free-ranging oodad, axis deer, and black buck hunts are often available at prices cheaper than your average whitetail lease. These animals are abundant in parts of Texas and other states, and many landowners are eager to thin the population, especially when free-ranging exotics start interfering with their deer management goals. Hunt pooling. The new carpool. You've heard of carpooling. Now meet hunt pooling. Outfitters frequently offer package deals for groups of four or more hunters. But what happens when a group of three can't find a fourth? That's where you come in. Put out feelers on social media or join forums and Facebook groups. You might find a group looking for one more person to round out a hunt, and in turn, you get in on a deal that would have been out of reach on your own. Better yet, organize your own hunt pool. Gather friends or fellow hunters, watch for bulk hunt discounts, and go in together. Offer your services at hunting ranches. Here's a little-known secret. A surprising number of outfitters hate cleaning game. They're busy managing clients, guiding hunts, and running the ranch. If you're local, offer to help process deer, skin hogs, or even help clean lodging facilities. Many hunters have struck up long-term relationships with outfitters by offering work in exchange for the chance to hunt during off-peak times or after clients head home. Think beyond just hunting. If you can cook, clean, guide, drive, run a tractor, or repair things you might have, what a hunting ranch needs. Think seasonally, strategically, and broadly. Maybe you lost your deer lease, but what about hogs? What about spring turkeys or late-season predators? Broadening your perspective might mean more time in the field, even if it's not in a tree stand come November. Keep an eye out for opportunities that come in the off-season. Many outfitters discount predator or hog hunts during the summer or winter months, and these hunts often lead to stronger relationships with the ranchers. Losing your lease is tough, but it doesn't have to be the end of your hunting story. In fact, it might just be the beginning of something more dynamic, more adventurous, and even more affordable. Use the tools at your disposal, such as social media, bartering, public land scouting, and smart group planning, to stay in the game. Hunting is changing. The old way of doing things with year-long leases with big checks still exists, but the new landscape offers some flexibility, more creativity. Don't be afraid to reinvent your hunting strategy. With some hustle and a positive outlook, you won't just bounce back, but maybe improve your hunting life. Honeydews and Don'ts. Bare Bones Hunting by Lou Marullo, Texas Fish and Game Hunting Editor. Here we go again, trying to get all those honeydew chores done before the whitetail season begins. It seems that as I get older, that honeydew list is getting larger. Or maybe I am just getting slower at getting things done. Oh well, gotta keep the wife happy so that when the season finally does arrive, you should have the time to yourself to spend countless hours in a tree stand and still come home to a smiling face. Am I right? Hello? The problem is that it is so hot these summer months that you do not feel like going out and walking to your hunting lease to check things out and make sure nothing has changed. Are the deer using the area still? Is there much whitetail sign, or have they found a better food source elsewhere? But these are exactly the things that you must do. You do not want to get up opening day at dark 30, head out and find that you are wasting your time. My advice to you is to be smart and take one day to make that dreaded walk. Yes, it will be hot, and yes, you might be miserable, but this writer feels it is a necessity that cannot be avoided. Once that chore is out of the way, I like to sit in my living room and use my computer to scope out new spots to hunt. If you have the means, then it might be a good idea to check out some of the states that border Texas and read about what they have to offer. There are plenty of reputable guides that would be happy to sign you up for a hunt this year or next. Some states will offer an over-the-counter, out-of-state license, while others require an out-of-state license online or via mail. A guided hunt can be tons of fun, and you can rest assured that your chances of seeing the game you are hunting will be very good. Whitetail deer, hogs, turkey, elk, and bird hunting are just a few of the great hunts. I know that here in Texas, we have all of those species right here. Why hunt anywhere else? Personally, I like hunting different areas. I once hunted deer in Missouri and saw the biggest buck I have ever seen in the wild. I watched as he mounted a doe. Never got a shot at him, but the hunt is etched in my memory banks for sure. One day, I would love to try my luck at moose up in Maine. Ah, the dreams. If you are one who just loves to fish, then a trip to different waters would be the ticket. In New York, near the small town of Oswego, huge salmon run upstream to spawn. Oddly enough, it is called the Salmon River. I brought Chester there once, and he had a ball when he hooked onto a monster fish, and I had a ball watching him struggle to keep his feet under him as he chased it down the river. It is really entertaining when someone hollers, "Fish on," because then you will see all the fishermen that have lined the banks of the river stand wall to wall and dance one leg at a time so they do not get the line of the runaway salmon caught on their boots. Someone should film that, put some music in the background, and post it on YouTube. If you are one of those grizzled hunters that likes to stay on his home turf, then I have a suggestion for you. On a cool morning, grab a rake and a small shovel and head out to your lease. Deer are creatures of habit, and they are also pretty lazy when it comes to walking in the woods. These animals will take the easiest route possible. If they can go under a fence instead of jumping over it, they will. They will not go where it is super thick with thorns unless they feel threatened. They will choose to go around it every time. With this in mind, check the area where you have placed your deer stands and see if there is a heavily used deer run that avoids your stand. If you find it, then place some logs and brush over the run itself, and with the shovel, clear a path that will offer you a nice 20-yard shot. Take your rake and clear any debris on the path. I will guarantee the deer will follow that new easy path right to you. Once they start using it, they will use it every day out of habit. That is why you need to get out there as soon as you can, on a cool morning, and get that work done. Give the deer plenty of time to get used to it, and voila, venison on the dinner table. I have written before in previous columns how important it is to check your gear before you get out in your stand. Go to the range now, while it is not filled with last-minute procrastinators, and get your rifle sighted in. Grab your bow and shoot some arrows so that your muscle memory takes over and you are accurate with every shot. If you consider yourself an ethical hunter, and I hope you do, then you should be doing these checks every year. Remember those honey-do chores I spoke of earlier? Well, now it is the time for those hunter-do chores. It is super important, so get them done and enjoy a successful hunting season in just a few more months. I know that I will be ready, and like you, the whitetail season could not come fast enough. Good luck to all. Have fun and hunt safe. Email Lou Marullo at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Fish Tech, a look at smart gadgets for fishing. Feature article by Matt Williams. Like or not, technology is here to stay. Advancements continue to surface in the tools we use in virtually every aspect of life, ranging from cutting the grass to preparing meals, communicating, and even vacuuming the floors of our homes. You just never know what might come down the pike next. So it goes in the fishing world, too. In fact, high-tech goodies seem to be way more prevalent today in fishing than other popular sports and hobbies. While many are linked to fishing electronics in one way or another, big tech is also making waves in battery power management and shallow anchor operation. It has also spurred new generations of artificial baits, digital scales, rods, reels, action cameras, and specialty fishing lines among manufacturers determined to keep pace with changing times and the insatiable appetites of anglers who are always looking to gobble up the next best thing. Though a few may seem more gimmicky than practical, there are some really useful tools out there that will help anglers to become more efficient at their game and ultimately catch more fish if they take the time to learn them. Here's a random list. Forward-facing sonar. No single fishing tool has changed the face of bass and crappie fishing more in recent times than forward-facing sonar has. It's the biggest thing since the spot-lock trolling motor, which relies on built-in GPS technology to tell the trolling motor to maintain its current position with the push of a button. Paired together, the two are a deadly combination. FFS functions via a special transducer that mounts to the trolling motor shaft, some sort of independent pole or a motorized turret mount. The transducer sends real-time data to an electronics screen and helps anglers detect fish and cover from a considerable distance. The technology allows for making precise bait presentations to fish and, more importantly, seeing how they react as a bait moves through the water column. Though not 100% foolproof, FFS usually leaves little question as to whether or not fish are present. If the fish move, anglers can quickly adjust. Sometimes it's possible to hound an individual fish with different baits until it bites. Garmin, Lowrance, and Humminbird are the leaders in FFS arenas. Phone apps. I've never been one to put my fishing faith in smartphone apps, but there are plenty of anglers who do. Most downloadable phone apps rely on Bluetooth or Wi-Fi connectivity for operation. Some are free, while others charge annual fees. There are all sorts of phone apps that allow anglers to gather useful pre-fishing data, like hotspots and waypoints on specific water bodies, gain map access, log private catch data, interact with other anglers, operate, manage fishing tournaments, check weather forecasts, select baits, and much more. Some of the apps are considered all-in-one apps, while others are dedicated strictly to bass fishing, fly fishing, and saltwater fishing. Angle.com provides great comprehensive review of fishing apps in multiple categories. The list doesn't end there, either. There are specialized apps that allow anglers to monitor and manage batteries, charging systems, and shallow anchors, including PowerPole, PowerPole Sea Monster app, and Minn Kota Raptor app. Additionally, the Bubba Pro Series Digital Scale has an exclusive app that allows for logging catch data, GPS coordinates, competing in virtual tournaments, utilizing live map tracking features, and sharing fish catches and other info on social media. Texas Parks and Wildlife's Toyota ShareLunker also uses a special phone app that allows anglers to enter their catches year-round. Castable Depth Finders. While there may not be a place in everyone's fishing arsenal, including mine, for one of these gadgets, a beginner or bank fisherman may find a castable depth finder like Garmin's Striker Cast GPS, $179, to be somewhat useful. Weighing 2.6 ounces, the floating device uses Bluetooth to turn a smartphone into a handheld depth finder. It is designed to be cast out, minimum of 20-pound test line is recommended, and reeled back to read bottom contours, find grass lines, underwater structure, and detect other areas that might be holding fish. Garmin says it features a 200-foot range, built-in GPS to provide the ability to create custom quick-draw fishing maps with 1-foot contours, 2D sonar and ice fishing flasher modes, and a rechargeable battery that lasts up to 10 hours between charges. To conserve battery life, the unit automatically powers on when floating in water and turns off when it's not. Underwater cameras. Ever spotted a group of fish on your depth finder and wondered about the species? AquaVu's Micro Revolution HD underwater camera will help eliminate the guesswork. Compact and portable, the nifty device supports HDMI and RCA output and allows for easy connectivity and crisp HD viewing on compatible screens like Garmin GPSMAP Series, Humminbird Apex, and Lowrance HDS Pro. The unit comes with 50 feet of durable cable that connects to AquaVu's patented Revolution cable management system for rapid deployment and easy retrieval. Bassmaster Elite Series Pro Jeff Gustafson says it is a handy tool for checking out brush piles, rock piles, and other potential sweet spots without the risk of burning a fish. It's also a great tool to keep kids occupied if they lose interest in fishing. Sells for $499.99. SeaBreaks 2.0. SeaBreaks are mini trolling motors designed to mount on existing shallow anchors, including power poles and Minn Kota Raptors. The motors act as brakes to help optimize boat control in deep water or in windy conditions, and help prevent spooking fish when using forward-facing sonar. Sold in pairs, the motors are available in 30 or 40-pound thrust for $1,650 to $1,800. Smart lures. The evolution of forward-facing sonar has resulted in the creation of a number of bass baits and other products that are designed or modified to get at suspended fish and provide better returns, so they show up better on sonar screens. Ballhead jigs, swim baits, and hover rigs are among the hottest new items with FFS junkies. There are dozens to choose from. Another is a product called Bait Pop Live Sonar Intensifier. Applied to hard baits, soft baits, and fishing line near the connection point, the scented gel is advertised to make lures show up significantly better on the sonar screen than without and leave a definitive scent trail. A half-ounce tube sells for about $10. As smart lures go, the Livingston lure family is arguably in a class all of its own. The company makes a wide range of baits for fresh and saltwater species that feature the company's patented EBS, electronic bait fish sound, technology. The technology relies on an internal smart chip that emits natural recordings of bait fish and other prey that is advertised to call predators from a distance. Check them out at livingstonlures.com. Thanks for listening. The five greatest boating inventions of the century. Texas Boating by Lenny Rudow, Texas Fish and Game Boating Editor. Here we are, a quarter of the way through the 21st century. Wow, time really does fly. Remember Y2K, Hanging Chads, and America Online? It seems like eons ago, but one thing that's progressed as rapidly as any is the tech found on our boats. And along with that tech, the awesome advancements that have made fishing boats far, far better than they once were. If you remember the above items hitting the news, you probably also remember chugging, sputtering two-stroke outboards, sticky mechanical controls, and standalone fish finders and chart plotters. Today, all that stuff has been surpassed by a mile. What are the five greatest advancements in the boating world, and which should you take advantage of if you haven't already? The answer is debatable, but if you've experienced any of these five advancements, you already know that a strong argument can be made for each. Number 1. Gyroscopic stabilization. The first time you're aboard a boat with a gyroscopic stabilization system, it feels like magic is at work. While early systems introduced in the 90s reduced rocking and rolling significantly, the first Seakeeper models, which hit the water in 2006, virtually eliminate it. The reduction in motion leapt from 40-ish% to 90-plus% with the development of a flywheel spinning in a vacuum and rapid hydraulic positional adjustment. But early versions were huge and hugely expensive. Fortunately, in the past 25 years, we've seen both size and cost shrink, and today you can outfit virtually any boat 23 feet and up with one for as little as $20,000 or so. That's not exactly chump change, but the reduction in cost has been huge and continues. If you want to make your boat vastly more comfortable, reduce the issues associated with seasick passengers, and make your fishing platform far, far better than it is today, the single biggest improvement you can make is likely adding one of these systems. As 2025 arrived, it brought with it more competition in the marketplace and new developments. Dometic now has its first gyro for boats on the market, featuring advancements like faster spin-up time, electric actuation rather than hydraulic, and lower power draw. Expect that over the next 25 years, we'll see more advancements, wider applications, and more market penetration, with hopefully even lower cost. 2. Vessel attitude control. These systems are essentially super fast, super smart trim tabs that can adjust so rapidly they constantly reduce pitch and roll as your boat moves across the waves. The idea gained acceptance with zip wakes, which cut a boat's motion noticeably. But once again, it was Seakeeper that took a good idea and made it great, this time with the introduction of their ride system. Motion reductions jumped from 30 to 40% to 50 to 70%. The difference you feel while cruising is so substantial that many boat builders have started rigging with ride as a standard feature. And cost is relatively low, usually less than 5% of the boat's overall price tag for a 20-something center console. Number 3. Joystick controls. Many seasoned mariners scoff at joystick controls on boats, but they do represent a great confidence builder for newer boaters. And in some situations, particularly on boats with three or more outboards, there's no question they do enhance control. Still, there's another reason anglers should consider them regardless of experience level: dynamic control. Even on single-engine boats, it's a serious advantage to be able to hold your position or control the drift orientation at the press of a button. And the only way to get these abilities is with a joystick system. Number 4. Side-finding fish finders. Remember when you had to stare at the blips on a ring to figure out if there were fish below the boat? We sure have come a long way since then. For many of us, fishing without a side finder feels crippling at this point, and the tech has advanced so much in the past couple of decades that we can now spot individual fish from hundreds of feet away. Meanwhile, the The capability of real-time imagers has become so great that you can watch how an individual fish reacts as your lure passes by. The applications are a bit more limited for real-time imaging than side scanning, but in the cases where it applies, the results are magnificent. 5. Lithium-ion batteries. Lithium-ion batteries are vastly superior to lead-acid. They're half the weight, live through far more discharge cycles, and that cycle provides full power from start to the end. In some cases, they can even provide enough power to replace a generator on larger boats. But among all the advantages they provide, the real boon for anglers is their use with trolling motors. We used to haul around 3 lead acids, weighing a total of maybe 150 to 200 pounds for a 100 amp hour 36 volt system. When fishing hard for a full day, that power package may or may not have run dry before the casting was complete. Today, a single 80 amp hour 36 volt battery weighs a mere 60 or 70 pounds and provides a steady stream of power that's virtually impossible to use up during a single day of fishing. The list of major tech advancements in the modern boating world is a long one, and whittling it down to the top 5 is no easy call. But when it comes to gyroscopic stabilization, dynamic attitude control, joysticks, side-finding real-time imaging, and lithium-ion batteries, one thing is undebatable. They make your fishing boat better. Email Lenny Rudow at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Charmed by Snakes. Doggett's Texas Snake Adventures continued. Feature article by Joe Doggett. During the decade of the 60s, between years at Lamar High School and the University of Houston, my snake collecting was pushed aside in favor of fishing, hunting, falconry, and increasingly surfing. Following higher education, in 1969, I had a 2-year commissioned detour on an aircraft carrier through the South China Sea to the Gulf of Tonkin. On return to Houston, I earned a respectable living for the next 50 years by writing about the outdoors, mainly the traditional sports of fishing and hunting. The profession of outdoor writing demanded extensive travel to the wild reaches of the state's ecological regions, and old habits die hard. Whenever the terrain and weather favored herptile movement, I would cast a keen eye in the direction of the nearest snaky brush pile or stream bank and seldom miss the opportunity to flip a piece of discarded plywood or cardboard. These opportunistic forays across snake-rich Texas yielded catch-and-release rewards, several grand indigos on deer and quail hunts in deep South Texas, the largest a stunning 7-footer from a deer lease near Carrizo Springs, as well as rat snakes, king snakes, bull snakes, hog-nosed snakes, rattlesnakes, copperheads, cottonmouths, coral snakes, and a slew of lesser species. The sight of even a ribbon snake always brought a quick thrill, and the sight of a freshly killed non-venomous snake always brought a surge of sadness. The good in most snakes far outweighs the bad. For example, the numerous rodent-eating species are among nature's perfect pest control agents, prowling 24/7 and capable of reaching tight places no trap or cat can touch. Many smaller species feed heavily on insects. Regardless of value, the senseless killing of a non-venomous snake minding its own business is lame behavior in a culture increasingly concerned with the environment. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Department now protects various reptiles as threatened species, not the least of which are the indigo snake and the canebrake, timber, rattlesnake. Prejudices aside, holding a docile snake is not all that appalling. Snakes are not slimy, the scales are firm and dry. Frogs are slimy, and eels are slimy, and fish are slimy. Snakes are reptiles. And myths aside, the forked tongue of a snake does not sting or otherwise impart harm. If the flickering sensor of a serpent is dangerous, I would have surely suffered the excruciating agony of death by a thousand tongues, rivaled only by the ancient Chinese torture of death by a thousand cuts. Native snakes are part of the chain of life, the natural order of things. Unless a confirmed pit viper or coral snake represents a clear and present danger to people or pets, the wise move is to leave any misto snake alone. Chances are, based on sheer numbers, it is non-venomous. Honest mistakes can occur, as several non-venomous species resemble copperheads and cottonmouths. Nobody can confuse a rattler, and coral snakes are rare and secretive. The most likely counterfeit copperhead in urban areas is the poor hognose, an ironic twist as pudgy little heterodon with its clever upturned snout is singular in its refusal to bite when handled. Several species of surly-looking water snakes can be mistaken for cottonmouths, and the broad-banded has the misfortune of resembling both the water moccasin and the copperhead. Good advice for the outdoor-oriented individual is to obtain a field guide for Texas snakes and study the lookalikes. Even subtle differences quickly become obvious to a trained eye. For example, as a comparison, two of the most popular full-sized SUVs are the Ford Expedition and the Chevrolet Tahoe. In boxy profile, they are very similar. But put the two vehicles of the same color side by side, and the experienced driver can promptly tell the difference. It's the same with snakes. Last fall, while on a surfing trip to Quintana Beach south of Freeport, I came across a large Texas rat snake. It was stretched out in a patch of low grass behind the primary dunes. I hit the brakes on my ancient two-door surf Tahoe and bailed from the driver's door and ran into the field. Surf fever literally taking a back seat to a serious dose of snake fever. The right hand snatched the startled snake behind the head. Mine. The old thrill of the naturalist's quest was back. It was an excellent specimen, at least 5 feet in length, with no visible scars or blemishes. It was of the light color phase, with a latticework pattern of yellow, orange, gray, and brown. The snake had recently shed, and the keeled scales glowed with a velvety sheen. I decided to temporarily keep it, the first in-house snake in years. The arboreal rat snake settled into a 3-foot glass terrarium furnished with a heavy water bowl, a wooden hidey hole, and a gnarled limb with several branches for climbing and draping. Captive snakes do not require much space, and this one adjusted well, never attempting to bite when handled, and taking a pair of unlucky pet shop mice every 2 weeks. Such a fine snake fueled the fire, and I spent hours rereading the old books, pleased to find that they still resonated. The rat snake was released in prime condition several months later. I drove to Quintana Beach one morning and turned it free near an undulating expanse of brush and grass near the original capture. The snake recognized the wildness as I opened my hands, and it shot like a tight stream of flowing liquid through the weeds and briars. Leaving the dunes, I drove through the low sandy country, the habitat of rattlesnakes, rat snakes, and king snakes. Herpetology can be a rewarding exercise of prowling the native habitat, and the snake collector, unlike the bird watcher, has the option of holding a prized specimen, even keeping it, assuming the catch is legal and the prospective handler is qualified. The barrier island was vital. Alive, a pair of native mottled ducks sprang from tall reeds along the roadside slough. Scattered mourning doves flushed from the sandy shoulders, corkscrewing up and away. A diminutive male kestrel perched atop a sagging telephone pole launched with sharp falcon wings, flashing slate blue and russet in the early light. The birds I could see. Any snakes remained a mystery. Up ahead, tangles of driftwood piled against a ridge of yellow weeds beckoned with the long-ago echo of the naturalist's quest. Maybe next time a speckled king snake. Better yet, a beautiful little prairie king snake. As a kid, I studied the books and walked the banks and prowled the fields and dreamed of becoming a real herpetologist. I would have been a good one. Thanks for listening. Gone Coastal. Fishing is serious fun for our Going Coastal columnist. Fishing Game Profile Series. Kelly Gross is a Texas-based outdoor writer, photographer, and angler who brings the Gulf Coast to life through her vivid storytelling and firsthand fishing adventures. As the author of our Going Coastal column, she takes a deep and fun look at fishing on the Texas coast. A native Texan and self-described water lover, Gross blends her passion for the outdoors with a strong background in communications. She holds a Bachelor of Arts in Communications and Public Relations with a minor in Global Business from the University of Houston, along with a Corporate Entrepreneurship Certificate from the Bauer School of Business. Her professional journey includes work in graphic design, marketing, and freelance journalism, with bylines in Saltwater Angler Magazine, Angler's Journal, and Gulf Coast Mariner. Gross's writing stands out for its authenticity and technical insight. Whether she's detailing the use of side imaging sonar to locate lingover wrecks or recounting a successful sheep's head outing, her articles are both informative and exciting. Beyond the page, Gross is an active angler and photographer. Her work captures the essence of coastal life, making her a respected voice among Texas anglers and outdoor enthusiasts. Through Going Coastal, she continues to inspire readers to explore and appreciate the rich fishing heritage of the Texas coast. Texas Fish and Game editor-in-chief Chester Moore said he has had the opportunity to fish with Kelly and said what he saw on social media was the exact person he spent time with on the water. Kelly is great. She's super passionate about fishing. There are many so-called fishing influencers who I'm suspicious of seeing fishing as anything other than an opportunity to cash in with their looks, charisma, etc., Moore said. Kelly talked about fishing all day, fished hard, and showed a serious heart for conservation and angler advocacy. We are proud to have her as a contributor to Fish and Game. Thanks for listening. Getting ready for the fall, a checklist for autumn hunters and anglers. Fish and Game Special Section. The summer heat is brutal across the Lone Star State, but make no mistake, fall is on the way. And for Texas outdoorsmen, that means it's go time. Whether you're gearing up for the thrill of opening day dove hunts, scanning the woods for a trophy buck, or setting the boat up for fall fishing for speckled trout under the birds, now is the time to prepare. Success in the field or on the water doesn't start when the season opens. It starts weeks or even months ahead of time, with smart planning, gear prep, and a mindset tuned to the rhythm of the wild. Here's how to hit the ground running this fall. Dove prep. Ask a Texas hunter what fall means, and chances are the word dove will be one of the first things out of their mouth. Dove hunting is a cherished tradition here. It's social, fast-paced, and ideal for sharpening shooting skills before the rest of the season's hit. Opening day, typically September 1st in the north and central zones, is practically a state holiday. But don't mistake tradition for guaranteed success. Dove hunting rewards those who plan ahead. Scouting fields. The best hunts happen where the doves are feeding, roosting, and watering. Identify grain fields, sunflower, milo, wheat, tree lines, and nearby water sources. Drive rural roads, glass open fields, and talk with local landowners about activity patterns. Dove can shift quickly based on weather and pressure, so check regularly in the days before the opener. Decoy strategy. Motion decoys like spinning wing types can draw birds in, especially on slow mornings. Combine these with static decoys on fence lines or tree limbs to add realism. Shotgun prep. Don't wait until the morning of the hunt to dust off your scattergun. Pattern your shotgun with the loads you'll be using, preferably 7.5 or 8 shot, and make sure your choke matches your expected range. Improved cylinder is a good choice. Clean the bore, check the action, and pack extra shells. Dove hunting can burn through ammo fast. Camo and concealment. Doves see movement well. Blend into your surroundings, wear lightweight camo, and stay still until it's time to shoot. A simple stool and some brush cover can make all the difference in the world. Regulations reminder. Dove are migratory game birds, so HIP certification is required. Double-check bag limits, usually 15 per day, with no more than 2 white-tipped doves, and know your zone's dates and shooting times. Maintenance. Whether you're in the dove field, deer stand, or fishing boat, working gear can make or break your fall. Inspect rifles, bows, reels, and optics. Lubricate moving parts, replace corroded batteries, and test trail cameras. For bow hunters, check limbs, strings, and broadheads. Anglers should re-spool reels, sort tackle, and examine boat motors, trolling systems, and sonar units. Make your checklist now so you're not scrambling the night before a trip. It's not just about convenience. Fitness prep. Texas terrain is tough. TFANG hunting editor Lou Marullo once said that everything in Texas tries to hurt you. If it doesn't bite or sting, it cuts you. Dragging a deer, carrying decoy bags, or even just hiking through thick brush in the heat can wear you down fast. Start conditioning early. A 30-minute brisk walk with a weighted backpack several times a week can do wonders. For bow hunters, regular practice at full draw builds stamina and improves shot execution. Anglers should work on lower back and grip strength. Fishing isn't passive, especially when targeting bull reds or sharks in the surf, or even making hundreds of casts with deep-diving crankbaits during the day. Field prep. Fall's game movements and fish activity are driven by food, water, and pressure. Start placing trail cameras now to pattern bucks while their summer routines are still predictable. Look for rub lines, bedding areas, and fresh scat. Even if you don't plan to hunt a spot right away, knowing what's there can inform future decisions. Waterfowlers can begin identifying potential potholes and flyways. Early teal hunters especially benefit from pre-scouting, as these birds are fast flyers and even faster movers. For anglers, this is transition time. Bass move from deep summer haunts toward shallow structure as temperatures cool. Crappie school tighter and move to deeper water. Learn your lake's contours and current flow while it's still quiet. Gear prep. The off-season rust is real. Rifle shooters should get to the range and practice from realistic hunting positions, such as kneeling, leaning on a tree, even offhand. Bow hunters should start daily or weekly shooting routines to build muscle memory. Shotgunners, especially dove hunters and waterfowlers, benefit from time on the skeet or sporting clays range. The instinctive shooting you'll need in the field doesn't come from sitting on the couch. Legal prep. Renew your hunting and fishing licenses now to avoid opening day hangups, and make sure you get all of your endorsements. Safety prep. Safety-wise, inspect tree stands and replace worn straps or cables. Life jackets on boats should be U.S. Coast Guard approved and in good condition. First aid kits, fire extinguishers, and GPS beacons can be lifesavers in a very literal way. Fall is the time to reconnect with the outdoors, to pass traditions down to the next generation, to fill the freezer, or just recharge the spirit. Whatever your reasons, write them down. Make a plan. Think about where you want to be on opening morning and make all of the preparations to get there. Enjoy your time in the field in the presence of beautiful habitats, incredible wildlife, and hopefully the people you love. Thanks for listening. The Fish and Game Report. News of the Outdoor Nation. Reported by Texas Fish and Game staff. East Texas gets new 6,900-acre wildlife management area. For the first time in almost two decades, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, TPWD, has added a new wildlife management area, WM, to its East Texas inventory. The property, comprising approximately 6,900 acres in Anderson County, will become the Trinity River Wildlife Management Area. Trinity River WMA is the newest addition to the Middle Trinity River Ecosystem Project, which includes Gus Engeling, Richland Creek, Big Lake Bottom, and Keechee Creek WMAs. Together, these properties protect more than 38,000 acres in East Texas. The newly acquired property also adds 11.3 miles of Trinity River frontage, giving TPWD more than 25 miles of riverbank conservation along this important corridor for migratory birds. The management and restoration of both the Trinity River and Richland Creek WMAs gives TPWD the opportunity for wall-to-wall bottomland conservation across the entire east-west width of the Trinity River Basin on more than 21,000 contiguous acres. These efforts will aim to slow waters during flooding events, allowing for natural river sediment to settle across the floodplain rather than downstream in areas where concentrated deposits cause environmental problems. The establishment of the Trinity River WMA presents an opportunity for the conservation and management of an ecologically unique and important habitat, said TPWD Executive Director David Yoskowitz. Partnerships with organizations like the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, the USDAG, Fish and Wildlife Service, and Knobloch Family Foundation make historic land purchases like this possible. The late Jackie Gregg, whose family owned the property, enjoyed seeing the blooming dogwood trees at the nearby Gus Engeling WMA and had a vision of her land being managed and protected in a similar fashion. The Gregg family worked closely with TPWD staff over the course of a year and a half to make this new WMA a reality. During the 88th legislative session, $10 million in migratory game bird stamp funds were appropriated to TPWD for the acquisition of new wildlife management areas. A portion of these funds, along with a grant awarded to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation from the Knobloch Family Foundation, provided the primary match for a federal aid in wildlife restoration grant from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The 88th Legislature's appropriation of migratory game bird stamp funds has allowed TPWD to conserve more lands and bring greater access to even more Texans, said TPWD Wildlife Division Director Alan Kane. TPWD will be working cooperatively with many partners to fund and prioritize habitat restoration on the new WMA. Wetland restoration and creation will be a primary effort, along with work focused on rebuilding bottomland hardwood on the Trinity River. Prairie restoration efforts will occur on the upland acres on the northern end of the property. These efforts will benefit numerous species, including waterfowl, shorebirds, neotropical migratory birds, butterflies, and many other wildlife. When appropriate, outdoor recreational opportunities, including hunting, birdwatching, camping, and fishing, will be available to the public. Avian flu, found in panhandle mammals. Recent testing has detected highly pathogenic avian influenza, H, in mammal species, including foxes, raccoons, striped skunks, and domestic cats, collected in Deaf Smith, Hansford, Luckletree, Palmer, and Randall counties. These detections resulted from a collaboration between Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, TPWD, the Department of State Health Services Zoonosis Control Branch, and the Texas Veterinary Medical Diagnostic Lab, following widespread detections in wild birds across Texas, with recent detections in Amarillo, El Paso, Galveston, Harris, Lubbock, Potter, Travis, and Wharton counties. Detected in all 50 states across the U.S. and Puerto Rico, HPAI is a highly contagious zoonotic virus that transmits easily among wild and domestic birds. It can spread directly between animals and indirectly through environmental contamination. For mammals, current data shows transmission occurs primarily through consumption of infected animal carcasses, though mammal-to-mammal transmission is possible. Clinical signs of HPAI in mammals may vary based on species and can include ataxia, incoordination, stumbling, tremors, seizures, lack of fear of people, lethargy, runny or crusty eyes and nose, coughing and sneezing, or sudden death. TPWD recommends wildlife rehabilitators remain cautious when intaking wild animals with clinical signs consistent with HPAI to limit the potential for exposures to other animals within the facility. The transmission risk of avian influenza from infected birds to people remains low, but people should take basic protective measures, i.e., wearing gloves, face masks, and hand washing, if they must make contact with wild animals. Those who locate wild animals with signs consistent with HPAI should immediately contact their local TPWD biologist. Thanks for listening. Red Hot Summer. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Upper Coast Focus, Sabine Area, reported by Captain Eddie Hernandez. If you'd like to experience the best of everything our beautiful bay system has to offer, all you have to do is load up and make a trip down here to Sabine during the super hot months. Despite the triple-digit heat index, the entire system tends to show off a bit during July and August. From the Gulf of America to the Neches and Sabine Rivers, and everywhere in between, you can get a taste of what she can deliver, given the right conditions. Those conditions should be favorable as we settle into the hottest of hot months and the heat wave begins to kick into high gear. I, like many other anglers, am beginning to get spoiled by beautiful summer water, abundant sunshine, temperatures pushing 100 degrees, light winds, and salt spray. The pretty water will bring increased salinity levels, and the fish will be pushed deep into the upper end of the lake and rivers. The trout bite should be very consistent in the Neches River. Although catching trout in the river and its tributaries is not that uncommon, as the Entergy Outfall Canal and Bessie Heights Marsh can give up some serious numbers year-round. The saltier the water gets, however, the farther up the river the trout will go. It's not uncommon for people to catch trout as far north as the Beaumont Yacht Club and beyond when the conditions are right. Sitting just a little south of the yacht club is the National Reserve Fleet. This area should be red hot for trout, redfish, and some nice flounder. Topwaters and plastics fished on the bottom or rigged under a popping cork are usually our go-to methods, but live finger mullet and shad can also be real killers for big numbers and some hefty fish. Fishing the ledges in 3 to 10 feet of water should keep you in the action. Across the lake on the lower end of the system, one of our favorite things to do for big trout and solid numbers is to throw topwaters in the Sabine Neches ship channel. You've got about a 2-hour window at daylight and before sunset when the trout can't resist the zigzag and sound of a topwater plug. Walking the dog over scattered shell in 2 to 8 feet of water is your ticket to success. Fishing pretty water with good tidal movement is essential if you want to have a good story at the end of the day. Concentrating your efforts on areas that are holding bait will also up the odds in your favor. The entire stretch of shoreline from Chenier and G to the jetties is second to none when it comes to attracting and holding bait and fish. The ever-changing bottom contour with fluctuating depths coupled with good tides from either direction is what keeps this area so consistent. Throw in green, salty water, and favorable winds, and you should be exactly where you need to be on hot summer days. The high pitch of Miralure's She-Dog or Rapala's Skitterwalk with its tight, easy-to-work pattern are popular choices for us when it comes to choosing a topwater plug that the fish can't ignore. Contact Captain Hernandez at ghgs.eddie@gmail.com or go online to goldenhookguide.com. Thanks for listening. Hope for the best. Fish and Game Forecast, Saltwater. Upper Coast Focus, Galveston Area. By Captain Derek York. I am hoping this summer, as we head into the middle of our hottest months, we are spared the extreme heat we have become accustomed to, but more than likely, hot and steamy days lie ahead for us all. But that doesn't always mean fishing is not good. Oftentimes, taking advantage of the early morning and late afternoon bites are most productive. Fast and steady action can occur across most of the major reefs in the Galveston Bay system for speckled trout and redfish. Soft plastics and live croakers seem to be the mainstays of bait preference for most people. Topwater baits can also be highly productive, and I have seen several very large flounder caught while drifting over reefs the past several years. It's always a nice surprise to see a big doormat come to the surface. While fishing the mid-bay reefs by boat is a great way to catch good numbers of fish during the summer, the beachfront also offers a great opportunity to get on some nice speckled trout. The key to finding the trout is usually just locating bait in the surf. A variety of baits work for this scenario. Trout will not be the only thing you hook up on. Metal spoons like Johnson Sprites, Castmasters, and others work awesome in the surf and can be cast a long distance. Topwaters and soft plastics also produce a lot of fish on the beachfront. And of course, it's always tough to beat fishing with live bait like shrimp and croakers. This is also my favorite time of year to venture offshore, looking for cobia, triple tail, and mahi-mahi. Typically, I don't have to venture too far offshore to find some of these fish. I usually stay in state waters, which go out to the 9 nautical mile line from the beach. Any floating debris, sargassum weed lines, or production platforms in our area typically have fish on them. I use mostly free-lined live baits for cobia and mahi on about a 2 to 3 foot fluorocarbon leader on a larger spinning setup. I will also keep a large swim bait to throw at them, especially if we have one swim up to the boat and we don't have a live bait ready to go. On my smaller spinning setups, I'll rig up some spec rigs with the 2 jig heads and tip them with squid or shrimp for the mahi. This type of fishing can be fast-paced and exciting, but can also take some time to find the fish some days. Persistence always pays off, though, eventually. Make sure if you get out during this time of year to be prepared for the heat, especially when taking young ones out with you. Stay hydrated, be safe, and have fun. Email Captain York at spotstalkerfishing@sbcglobal.com. Thanks for listening. Grinding Through the Heat, the Fish and Game Forecast Center, Upper Coast Focus, Matagorda Bay Complex, reported by Captain Mark Talasek. It is the middle of the summer grind. Daily, near triple-digit temperatures have worn out their welcome. I am looking forward to some fall weather. It's been a hot, dry one. We have been leaving early and returning to the dock when the sun burns us off the water around noon. Good numbers of quality trout have come from drifting deep shell with a popping cork. Live shrimp or gulp works well. The Gulf of America is always productive along the shoreline when wind calms. Wade fishing helps keep things cool. My T-top provides some relief when we stay in the boat. I prefer flounder gigging this time of the year to beat the heat. Everyone seems to enjoy this nighttime activity from toddlers on up. Flounder gigging is a combination of hunting and fishing. It's a great way to beat the heat and put some fish in the box. Our trips leave as the sun is setting on the horizon, searching the shoreline for clear water. Some people walk with gigs and a light. I prefer to stay in my custom-made airboat. Once we arrived at our destination, the outboard goes off and the air motor goes on. Lights mounted on the front handrail illuminate the bay floor. Crabs, mullet, trout, reds, stingrays, and of course flounder liven up the water. It takes a trained eye to distinguish between a flounder and the sand. They blend in on the bottom to prey on food, also to prevent being preyed upon. We gig the flounder with special-made spears. It's one of the most productive ways to take fish from saltwater. Keeps everyone involved and on their toes. Flounder season is full throttle, except November through December 15th, when the state shuts it down. This allows some of the bigger female flounder to make their annual run to the Gulf and reproduce. Give me a call to book your next trip to Matagorda at 979-479-1397 or reach me online. Contact Captain Talasek at marktalasek@sbcglobal.com or go online to talasekguideservice.com. Thanks for listening.
Targeting summer specs. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Middle Coast Focus, Port O'Connor, reported by Captain Kim Golden. There's something timeless about a Texas summer morning on the water, the orange glow of dawn creeping over the bay, mullet flipping in the shallows, and the distant splash of a speckled trout breaking the surface. For anglers across the Lone Star State, summer marks prime time for chasing specks, as these prized game fish feed aggressively in warm, shallow waters all along the Texas coast. Whether you're slinging topwaters at sunrise or drifting with lures along a grass flat, summer speckled trout fishing is a blend of strategy, patience, and pure excitement. In this column, we'll explore the best tactics, gear, and hotspots to help you make the most of speck season on the Texas coast. To consistently catch speckled trout during the summer, it helps to understand what drives their behavior this time of year. As water temperatures rise into the 80s and beyond, trout seek out areas where they can feed efficiently while avoiding thermal stress. This often means hunting in the cooler, shallower waters during early mornings and late evenings, then retreating to deeper channels, guts, or drop-offs as the sun climbs higher. Summer is also peak spawning season for specks. Larger female trout, commonly called gator trout, are often found staging near tidal passes and deeper structure, conserving energy while feeding heavily to support reproduction. Their prey menu is varied. Shrimp, finger mullet, pin perch, and croaker top the list. So understanding what forage is most abundant in a given area can help you choose the right bait or lure. When it comes to targeting speckled trout in Texas, the coastline offers a diverse range of productive waters that cater to both novice and seasoned anglers. Each bay system has its own unique characteristics, but all share one common factor during the summer: abundant trout looking for their next meal. Port O'Connor's bay system provides a blend of shallow back lakes and open bay shorelines, making it a versatile destination. During summer, trout concentrate along grass lines, drop-offs, reefs, and sandbars. The overall shallow nature of these waters makes it the perfect destination for wade fishing enthusiasts. Tackle and gear. Having the right gear can make all the difference when fishing for speckled trout in Texas's summer heat. Whether you're walking a shoreline at sunrise or drifting across a bay, your setup should match the conditions and presentation style you're using. Rods and reels. A medium light to medium spinning or bait casting rod, typically 6 to 7 foot, is ideal for trout fishing. Pair it with a smooth reel spooled with 20 to 30 pound braided line and a 20 pound mono leader. Braided line offers increased sensitivity, crucial for detecting light bites, and allows for longer casts, especially important when trout are spooky in clear summer water. The mono leader allows a loop knot for artificial lures and some stretch. Wading essentials. For wade anglers, breathable waders or lightweight pants, a quality wading belt, and a secure fish bag are key. Don't forget polarized sunglasses for spotting bait movement, and always wear wading boots with stingray protection in shallow waters. Summer speck strategies. During the heat of summer, knowing when and how to fish for speckled trout is just as important as where. The key is to adapt your tactics to the time of day, water conditions, and the trout's feeding patterns. Here are some proven techniques that consistently produce fish during Texas summers. Wade at first light. Wading remains one of the most effective ways to target specks in skinny water. Start early to take advantage of cooler temperatures and increased fish activity. Cast toward sand pockets, grass edges, and drop-offs using topwaters, suspending twitch lures or soft plastics. Wade quietly, work slowly, and keep your eyes peeled for bait fish or subtle surface disturbances. Drift with lures. When trout move deeper later in the morning, drift fishing becomes a go-to method. Use a drift sock to slow your movement across grass flats or shell beds, and cast subsurface artificial lures that can reach the lower part of the water column. Topwater action. Few things beat the visual excitement of a trout crushing a topwater lure. These lures excel at dawn, dusk, and even on overcast days. Walk the dog lures like the Miro Lure She Dog are favorites. Just remember to pause occasionally to trigger reaction strikes. Larger fish often strike at the end of a retrieve or right after a pause. Best baits and lures. Choosing the right lure can make or break your day on the water. During summer, speckled trout are actively feeding, but that doesn't mean they'll hit just anything. Matching your offering to the local forage and water conditions is key to getting consistent bites. Topwaters. Walk the dog lures like the Miro Lure She Dog are summer standouts. A bone or white topwater is a must-have. Soft plastics, rat-tail and paddle-tail plastics, twitch baits, and shrimp imitations rigged on jig heads work great for covering water. Popular choices include Miro Lure and Down South lures. Suspending baits. For targeting deeper fish or pressured trout, slow-sinking twitch baits like the Mirodyne or Catch 2000 can coax reaction strikes with a subtle retrieve. For shallower offerings, Texas Custom Lures Double D is a phenomenal ascending twitch bait that flits irresistibly over shallow grass beds. Color and size tips. In the summer's clear waters, natural colors like white, bone, silver, and translucent patterns often outperform brighter choices. However, if the water is murky after a storm or high wind, switch to chartreuse head dark body or darker hues for visibility. Texas Custom Lures 1/16-ounce 2-0 short-shanked chartreuse jig head is always in my gearbox. Catch and release culture. More Texas anglers are practicing selective harvest, keeping only what they'll eat and releasing the rest. Big trout are the future of the fishery, and preserving them helps ensure quality fishing for years to come. Summer speckled trout fishing on the Texas coast isn't just about filling a stringer, it's about the experience. The quiet thrill of a sunrise wade, the sudden jolt of a topwater strike, the rhythm of the tides, all of it adds up to something far bigger than just a day on the water. Whether you're chasing a gator trout or quantity bite, the fish are out there and the memories are waiting. So rig up, fish smart, and take care of the resource, because some of the best stories start with a cast into a summer morning. Contact Captain Golden at kimgoldenfishing@gmail.com or go online to portoconnorfishingtrip.com. Thanks for listening.
Between the grass and sky, the Fish and Game Forecast Center, Middle Coast Focus, Upper Laguna Madre, reported by Captain Richard Thompson. Dawn breaks slowly over the Laguna Madre, the sky brushed in pale pink and orange before the sun could turn mean. In South Texas summer, the window is short. By midday, the heat presses down like iron. I say it's like a sprint and not a marathon to get your morning wade in and or wait till the evening as the breeze typically starts to turn on again. We, as well as all our other guides down here in the Upper Laguna and mouth of Baffin Bay, have been extremely successful catching slot redfish and beautiful trout. The bay system is so alive right now, and she is ready for you to reel in your limits and fill up your freezers. I typically stand knee-deep in skinny water, taking advantage of the only hour's worth of fishing. In the stillness of early light, before the day hardens, anything feels like it's possible. I practice this method until mid-morning and jump back into the boat to start drift fishing to follow the summertime patterns of the bigger fish as they descend into the deeper drop-offs. I have to admit, all winter, spring, and now summer, I've refocused my lure choices to soft plastics all day every day on all of my guided and personal trips. I historically use topwaters and suspending plugs like Fat Boys. My setup looks like a coastal brew bait or a down south lure, big smooth, rigged on a light jig head. There's something more precise about soft plastics, more connected. Each cast feels intentional, and with every twitch of the rod, I reel in the slack, covering more ground one subtle pulse at a time. My focus during summer in the great search for bait that actually produces larger species below is a constant. I scan the surface for signs, small flickers of glass minnows over the grass beds, the sudden ripple of finger mullet erupting like a skipped stone. A lone tern hovers, then dives hard, pulling something silver from the chop. That tells me menhaden are nearby, pushed into the shallows by something bigger. Even the pinfish seem more active, clicking and darting along the grass edge. Every movement of bait is a whisper from below, an invitation to cast, to search. You learn over time that reading the water isn't just about eyesight, it's about listening to the language of life beneath the surface, because it's all about the thump. Moments like this don't ask for celebration, they ask for reverence. I feel a quiet gratitude for the cast, the catch, the life that swims away, and the rare beauty of being here to witness it all. This feeling is what I try to relay and articulate to each and every one of my customers. Our lodge, Laguna Shores Lodge, has been filled up and is ready for you to book your next coastal getaway with R&K Coastal Outfitters. Crystal Thompson and I welcome you with a warm smile. Contact Captain Thompson at rnkcoastaloutfitters@gmail.com or go online to rnkcoastaloutfitters.com. Thanks for listening. Stretching Your Legs, the Fish and Game Forecast Center, Middle Coast Focus, Rockport, reported by Captain Jared McCulloch. It's summertime and we all know our favorite summer spots. Wading is cool and easy with nice hard sand with mixed grass. Knee-high water is holding big trout just waiting on the right lure to wiggle by. With the tall summer grass height, the topwater comes right back to being my friend. More casts without fighting grass and good noise will help to trigger a strike. I like to put three different topwater lures in my wading bag. One with a heavy knocker, a medium, and of course the little beads for that quiet rattle. On calm mornings, you can bet trout are going to want to be picky. Change up your retrieves until you get a strike. I prefer bright silvers and golds once the sun is up on a small or medium-sized topwater. Don't want to get out of the boat? Hard to blame you. We all know that cooler is full of refreshing drinks. But there's usually a lot of boat traffic come summertime. And is it picking on the fish you've been on? Quite possibly. There have been plenty of trips with customers where a boat runs by and a steady bite stops. There have been trips where a boat runs by and they spook a group of reds nearby as well. An easy way to find your next target is when they mud up a little spot. So, we are left with the great question, work with the extra traffic or make a longer run than normal and get away from it. There are plenty of Saturdays where I tell customers to get comfy. We are going to make a run. Spots like Panther and Spider in the middle of San Antonio Bay don't see a lot of love in the summer. There are plenty of no-name reefs that haven't been picked on up there. The same goes with shorelines. Don't forget about the close-by reefs out in the middle of these bays either. Deeper water will keep a lower temp, and the calm summer weather will allow an easy day out there as well. Whatever you choose, stay calm and cool out there. Everyone is on the hunt and looking to find some tug on their line. Contact Captain McCulloch at firstlighttexas@gmail.com or call 210-478-6519. Thanks for listening. Hot and loving it. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Lower Coast Focus. Baffin Bay. Reported by Captain Jared Merritt. Summer is in full swing in our part of the world, and although the heat can get to us, we are enjoying it. Now that July and August are here, and the weather and water are both heating up, This is my favorite time of year to be out on the water. Winds are starting to lay, and the water is turning nice and green just when we need it. As the water temperature rises, it changes a few things for us down here on Baffin Bay, even though we are still making the occasional trip into the Laguna and Landcut. We are still throwing out our beloved croakers, but also using the occasional shrimp, along with soft plastics and topwaters, while wade fishing. As the sun gets higher and hotter, we move to cooler waters. The rocks in Baffin Bay are producing, but moving around is key to finding the proper water depth for holding fish. I know some things stay the same in these reports, but that's what we do every day, trying to figure out a pattern. Once we do, we continue to fish the same areas and methods. I believe in the motto, "It works until it doesn't," and when it does not, I normally try to make a significant change. This method is not guaranteed to work every time, but more often than not, it helps me get things figured out. The flats are producing in the cooler parts of the day. Once I've figured out that time is running out in the morning and the shallow areas of Baffin Bay are not cooperating, the deeper rocks or moving water of the Laguna Madre and Landcut tend to be a must-try. Trying to match the watercolor or finding something that will sparkle and make a little noise when fishing with lures is the go-to this time of year. Again, we start by hitting the flats early and fishing deeper water later in the day, unless I have the trout and redfish locked down already. This is how I judge where to start and what to do when we decide to throw croaker. Although croakers are the go-to bait for me and most of my clients, every now and then, a simple shrimp can change the game, along with getting out of the boat and chasing these beautiful fish on foot. Whether it be live bait or soft plastics, chasing these fish is what I love and continue to try to better myself every day. Contact Captain Merritt at jaredmerritt@gmail.com or visit his website, paradiseguideservices.com. Thanks for listening. Big Bulls, Tasty Ling, Calm Flats, the Fish and Game Forecast Center, Lower Coast Focus, Lower Laguna Madre, reported by Captain Brian Barrera. Once July comes around, I'll be spending 90% of my time chasing big fish, really big fish. Time will be spent fishing deep water such as deep channels, nearshore wrecks, offshore structure, and the local surrounding inlets. In July, the wind can still be pretty gusty in the late mornings, sometimes causing you to stay further inland, but for the most part, I like to hang out at the jetties, chasing bull reds and large jack crevalle, using many different styles of fishing and baits. I usually start with a big gold spoon or live finger mullet to target these fish. Sometimes the schools of jack crevalle will school up near the surface, creating opportunities for a great surface strike using big topwater poppers. As the weather and winds start to lay consistently, late July through August, I like to get out to nearshore wrecks and other close-by structures within state waters and target big ling using big live baits or bucktail jigs. These fish are great eating and are always invited to the cookout. They are known to be very curious, so most of the time you'll be able to sight cast them by the boat, but on some days I have to use my electronics to locate how deep they are or on what side of the structure they are hanging out. I use bigger gear, like 6 to 10,000 size spinning reels with 65-pound braid and 80-pound leader. This calm weather also brings great opportunities to find large schooling groups of redfish and black drum on the flats. Cruising around at a slow speed, I look for jumping bait and big schools of fish moving near the surface in certain or any direction. This makes cutting off their movement a lot easier. Not only for fishermen using a trolling motor off of a boat, but also wade fishermen. I love throwing quiet topwaters and heavy jigs to make sure I can get the distance if I need to for these fish. Contact Captain Barrera at captbrianbfishing@gmail.com or visit his website, inshorefishingsouthpadre.com. Thanks for listening. Survival Skills, Open Season, by Revis Wortham, Texas Fish and Game Humor Editor. The Grand Critters gathered around the cabin's fire pit on an evening so hot the added temperature of a campfire would blow the top out of a thermometer. I wipe sweat out of my eyes. So why aren't we doing this when it's cold? That's not yours, Telly. The War Department plucked an edged weapon from the hands of the youngest grandchild with less fuss than flicking a piece of lint off his sticky, stained Ninja Turtles t-shirt. So they can build fires this winter. They're all old enough to learn how. That one's 3. Never too early to start learning survival skills. The skill they'll learn today will be how to survive the heat. I felt the sting of the summer sun on the back of my neck. Besides, someone'll burn themselves. She gave me her ever-optimistic smile. It's part of learning about fire. At least the fire pit was in the shade. Knowing better than to argue with a woman who'd made up her mind, I waved them over. All right, you heathens, let's gather up some little sticks like this. I held up a twig thinner than a toothpick. Parker, the 8-year-old, ran away and came back with a thick piece of stove wood. He held it out with one hand. How about this? I took it from him, lest he drop it on someone's Crocs and smush a toe. Let's put the log to the side until later. We have to start small. Someone fetch me some dried grass, he frowned. What is this? Fetch! 3-year-old Telly reached down and snatched up 2 handfuls of green grass and threw it onto the twigs I'd arranged in a tiny tent. Fast reactions, buddy. I gave his chili bowl haircut a little pat. But it needs to be dry grass, like an old bird nest. In fact, if we had one of those, we'd just light it. Give it a few minutes, and that grass will be dried out in this heat, said Riley. At 10 going on 18, and a voracious reader, she's developing the art of sarcasm. I glanced up at the tree high above us. At age 6, Caden's a little monkey. What are you doing way up there? Getting you a bird nest. The limbs it's sitting on is smaller than these twigs. Get down from there. Caden has been here in another life. The first time he picked up a water gun at age 3, he approached me at high ready and fired a stream of water into my chest with a perfect 2-hand grip. Riley studied the pile of tinder. Why do we have to do it this way? It's how we learn to build fires. Why don't you just stack up some of that wood by the porch and squirt some of that stuff in the white bottle on it? That's how you usually do it. Well, that's an old Indian trick my daddy taught me, but we're going to learn with small fires today. I'd show y'all how to do it with a flint and steel, but one of y'all borrowed it and we're back to matches. After I'd sweated out a couple of buckets, they'd scraped up enough fuel to get started. I built a small mound of twigs and grasses. With those components, I sat aside a pile of progressively larger pieces of wood that would soon provide enough heat and coals to start the fire. So once you have this all gathered together, you make sure the wind won't blow out your match and light it. I struck a match on the box and heard Caden beside me. Happy birthday. He blew it out. Dude, we're trying to make a fire here, not light birthday candles. Telly leaned close. My turn. Guys, we're not here to blow out matches. Telly stuck an index finger in his mouth and spoke around it. It's my turn. Get your finger out of your mouth. You were handling worms a few minutes ago. It tastes good. He held out the wet digit. Taste it. Don't want to. I lit the twigs. See how fast this little stuff burns? Now watch. It'll get really hot. The wet digit appeared in front of my eyes. Taste it. Offer it to your mother. The tiny flame caught and grew. Parker picked up the small log he'd offered before. Now, you'll put it out. We need some sticks the size of your fingers. Splaying his fingers as measuring instruments, he wandered off to find firewood, ignoring what I'd collected. Are we ready for these? 9-year-old granddaughter Logan came out of the house with wire hangers and a bag of marshmallows. Not yet, and you probably need to get that bag back inside before they turn into marshmallow cream. That's what Nana uses to make that pie you like so much. Take them in and bring me some Fritos. I'll show you something. Caden tried to blow the fire out, but it was burning too good. I want hot dogs. You can't cook them if you kill the fire. I wiped away the sweat running down into my eyes and picked up a more substantial stick and added it to the growing flames. Now all we have to do is keep adding bigger and bigger pieces of wood, and it'll be big enough for Caden's hot dogs. Riley studied the fire for several minutes. It's too hot for this. Looking like a petulant teenager, she headed into the house to enjoy the benefits of technology, air conditioning. I looked at the War Department, who took the now straightened hangers away from the boys who were using them as swords. She pointed at a clear space in the fire pit, away from the existing blaze. Show them how to start a fire with Fritos and then Vaseline. You realize we're giving them the knowledge to burn the house down. You knew early. And we almost burned the house down, along with the hay barn, the chicken house, and once cousin set the pasture on fire. Logan came back with a small bag of Fritos and dumped them onto the already burning fire. Now what? Well, that's not what I had in mind. There's a way to light one at a time and use them to start fires, but... The fire sizzled and hissed as the grease-infused chips caught fire and burned harder. Parker came around the corner with a small log, and Telly ran up to him, extending his finger. Taste this. They still had a long way to go, but I felt we were on the right track. Fighting hyperthermia, I set the log aside and we sweated beside a roaring fire, content in the knowledge that we could build another one when the temperature finally cooperated. Email Revis Wortham at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. This concludes this audio edition of Texas Fish and Game Magazine, July-August 2025. We hope you have enjoyed this issue. Print and digital versions of this publication are available on our website, fishgame.com. This has been a production of Texas Fish and Game Publishing Company, LLC. Copyright 2025. All rights reserved.